Coming up Saturday morning at 6 on Hometown Heroes. He's been in Modesto for 65 years. He may even have been your principal or math teacher. And he flew 43 missions in World War II.
We flew alone at night, no fighter escort.
There were no explosives in the bombs he dropped, and those missions were all about saving lives. Hear his one-of-a-kind story as only he can tell it on Hometown Heroes. Saturday morning at 6 on Power Talk 1360 and 1280.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some men and women around you who have pretty remarkable stories, and it sure is amazing to hear them. Each week we visit with veterans of World War II. We want to honor them for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, boy, do we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, we're inspired by these stories. And I know that'll be the case today. If nothing else, you've got to get on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page and see the picture of these newlyweds that are celebrating their 71st anniversary. You're not going to believe they're even 71 years old. I'm telling you, check out the photo. And let's hear the voice of 91-year-old Eugene Mold, Army Air Corps veteran from World War II, with a really unique story about what you did during the war. I've heard a lot of different jobs from different servicemen on this program, but never someone who did exactly what you did. But let's start earlier on, before we get to your fly-in days. Growing up in the East Bay, before World War II, what was your childhood like? What kinds of things were you up to or dreaming of as a young boy?
I was active in activities in high school, sports, journalism, orchestra, student government.
You did it all.
And did a lot of things, yes.
And this was Diablo Union High School?
Mount Diablo Union High School in Concord.
Uh-huh. What was your best sport?
Basketball. I was all of 5'8".
It's not the size of the dog in the fight.
Yeah.
And you said orchestra. What instrument did you play?
I played violin.
Uh-huh. A man of many talents.
Thank you.
And when did you first encounter a young lady named Anita?
When we were in high school, she was a sophomore. I was a senior.
Uh-huh.
And she asked for the first date.
Oh, so I can't call you a cradle robber. No, it was the other way around.
Yeah, yeah.
Was it your basketball prowess or your musical talents that you think brought her over?
I think it was my good looks.
Well, judging by the fact that you still fit into your Army Air Corps jacket 70 years later, that must have something to do with it. And maybe some folks are recognizing your voice. Maybe you have some of your former math students in Modesto schools, or maybe you were their principal at Modesto High School, and they're saying, oh, Mr. Mold, good to hear you again. But maybe they haven't heard your stories from the war. One question that I like to ask everybody, because everyone seems to remember something. December 7th, 1941, where were you, and how did you hear that Japan had attacked Pearl Harbor?
I don't remember how I got the news. I was a carryout clerk at Safeway stores in Concord, yes.
Uh-huh. You're carrying grocery bags out to people's cars?
Yes, correct.
And you were doing that Sunday?
Yes, I was, yes. I'm not sure I knew what it meant. I don't think I understood the consequences.
When did that hit home for you?
Sometime when I began my own training to be a bomber pilot.
Well, where did that come from? What made you want to be a bomber pilot? Or maybe you wanted to be a fighter pilot?
No, I wanted to be a bomber pilot. I enlisted in the Army Air Corps and when I was a sophomore at UC Berkeley. I got called to active duty in March of 43.
Mm-hmm. I've heard stories about the Bay Area in the aftermath of Pearl Harbor. And I've heard people talk about blackouts and having to turn off all the lights at night, fears that the Japanese were going to bomb San Francisco. Do you remember any of that tension at the time?
Yeah, my father was a warden on the street we lived to monitor lights out when necessary.
What would he do if they didn't?
I don't know what his big threat was.
Huh?
I don't have a recollection on that one.
What would he do to you if you left your light on?
Yeah.
Did you have brothers and sisters?
I have two older sisters and a younger brother.
So you're the first one from your family to join this war effort?
Yes, I was. Yes.
So what was it about the Army Air Corps and bombers specifically that sounded like something you wanted to do?
Well, you know, we all, at that age, we all knew we were subject to the draft. So the smart thing to do was to enlist so you could get the branch of service that you wanted. And I had just decided, for whatever reason, the Army Air Corps.
Had you ever flown a plane before?
No.
Had you ever flown in a plane before?
Once, as a child.
Uh-huh.
Don't remember much about it.
So this was just a whole new world for you.
Yes, exactly.
And I think everybody could tell already that, you know, if you're 91 years old and you're so mentally sharp and you're a math teacher and a principal, you're a pretty smart guy. A lot of times I talk to people that were in the Army Air Corps, and one of the big challenges was some of the academic work that they had to do and the courses they had to take, the things they had to understand. Was any of that challenging for you?
Not academically. I struggled a little bit with Morse code. We had to pass a test on that, and eventually I did, but it wasn't my strong area.
How did that test work? What did you have to do?
We had to record messages sent by teletype and then record them on paper.
So that was a little nerve-wracking to...
No, I just didn't pick it up as rapidly as some others.
Hard to separate the diff from the da and all that.
Huh? Yeah.
Well, I'm glad you passed it.
Thank you.
What was it like the first time that you got to fly, that you got up in the air and felt yourself at the controls?
Well, you know, it was a very good experience. It was a primary trainer. It was an open cockpit, instructor in the back, a pilot in the front, wear a helmet and goggles, no radio.
Mm-hmm. A little different than how it goes today, huh?
Yeah, quite a bit, yeah.
Did you ever wonder, am I doing the right thing here? Did I make the right choice?
No, I was confident that I was where I wanted to be and should be.
Uh-huh. The first time that you got to fly a B-17, what was that like?
The first bomber I flew was a B-24.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and that's the biggest airplane going at that time.
Yeah.
A lot of power. Four engines each, 1,200 horsepower. Had to have a co-pilot and a flight engineer.
Well, and you said the plane had a lot of power. From what I've heard from B-24 pilots, the pilot had to have a fair amount of strength to get that puppy off the ground and to control it.
Yes, we did. Yeah, it wasn't power assist like they have these days. So if you lost an engine on one side or two engines on one side, you needed a lot of strength to keep the airplane headed the way you wanted it to.
Mm-hmm. Did I have it wrong? Were you flying B-24s, not B-17s over there?
I flew both. No, you had it
okay,
right. I flew
okay.
both.
All right.
Yeah, I flew about
sure.
half my missions in each mm-hmm. each aircraft.
So you flew both the B-17 and the B-24, mm-hmm. and I've been hearing for years from B-24 pilots over here and B-17 pilots over here saying, my plane's better than your plane. No, my plane's better than your plane. And you flew them both. So where do you fall in that holy war?
I fall slightly on the side of the B-24 because that was my initial training.
Mm-hmm.
But the B-17 was a better airplane for climbing than the B-24.
Got it. So you said you want to be a bomber pilot. I'm sure you envisioned going over there and dropping bombs with little messages to Hitler written on them, right?
No, I had no idea I would be assigned to that kind of a squadron. Yeah.
No, I meant literally bombs, you know, why you paint Hitler on the side or something like that.
Oh,
you
yeah.
thought you'd be dropping actual bombs,
yes,
right?
Yes, I did. Yes.
I'm sure you trained in regular bombers, right?
Yes. The planes we flew were the same as the ones that dropped explosives.
Right.
Just had different cargo, different kinds of bombs.
Very different kinds of bombs. Mm. And we're going to learn all about that. Throughout that training, because, you know, I always talk to veterans about their missions and combat and the different things they experienced there. But I've had a lot of guys that tell me some really interesting stories about the training and that we kind of take for granted that, you know, training happens and people get through it and it's no big deal. But there are a lot of people that died in training. There are a lot of people that didn't make it through training. Was there anything throughout that training period that sticks out in your memory that was either difficult or noteworthy for you?
No, it was pretty routine. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No tragedies that I recall, at least. So. Mm-hmm.
Was it exciting for you to do this kind of work?
It was exciting, and at the same time, it was just what you did. You were assigned, and you did it.
Mm-hmm. And when did you head overseas?
July of 44.
Mm-hmm. You got to fly over?
I flew a B-24 from Marin County to the East Coast to Iceland to England.
The northern route, huh?
Yeah. So I'm a transcontinental pilot with one flight.
In a B-24?
In a B-24.
Not too many people can claim that. Were you a little nervous or anxious heading over there, not knowing what to expect?
No, I don't remember being nervous, no.
You were ready to get into it?
Yeah. When we got to Iceland, the weather was good, so we didn't have much of a stay there. So I was tired a little bit on the flight to England, but I don't remember being nervous.
Mm-hmm. When was it that you found out that you would be dropping different kinds of bombs, that your missions, that your assignment would be different than your typical bomber?
Yeah, when I got to England. Mm-hmm. Didn't know before that.
So none of your crew knew?
Correct.
So how did that all come about?
We were just assigned, that's all. You know, we had no say in it. Nobody consulted with us. We were assigned, and okay, that's what we're going to do.
Was there a little head scratching? First of all, tell us what this cargo, what these bombs, quote-unquote bombs, were, and how that news was broken to you.
Well, the airbase where we were, that's what they did. So we found out we were a night leaflet squadron, and we airplanes we flew were painted black. We had 10 huge bombs stuffed with leaflets, and we would put two or three on each target or city in one mission.
Mm-hmm. Did you even know that that idea existed, that that was happening in the war?
No, I didn't know that. And I found out probably after I completed my missions, we were part of the Secret Service, but nobody told us that.
Uh-huh.
Probably for good reason, so so we wouldn't know. We were instructed not to look at leaflets.
Uh-huh.
So they were in German, so it was kind of a moot point. But in case we were shot down, then we didn't know anything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and I just caught myself here. I skipped something. There was a pretty significant development for you before you headed overseas, wasn't there?
Yeah, my wife and I got married 3 months before I went overseas.
Was that a difficult decision for you? Because I've talked to a lot of guys who did that, and I've also talked to a lot of them and said, hey, I wanted to wait to make sure I came back before I got married.
No, we just decided, okay, we don't want to wait. We want to be married. And so we had about 3 months of marriage, and then I left for overseas.
Mm-hmm. How hard was that to leave behind this?
That was tough.
Yeah.
That was tough, yeah.
You don't strike me as an overly sentimental guy. Am I reading you right?
Yeah, probably.
But did you find yourself wondering, am I ever going to see her again?
Yeah, that crossed your mind. But the other thing was, if you're going to fly a mission that night, your name with your crew was on the bulletin board, and you said, okay, I'm going to fly a mission.
No big deal.
Yeah, yeah, just do it.
Did you carry a photo of her with you on your mission?
She sent me a photo that I treasure. Still have, of course.
Still have it?
Yeah.
And where did you keep it while you're over there?
Next to my bunk.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So they tell you you're in this night leaflet squadron, which you've never heard of before.
Right.
And that you're going to be dropping bombs, but there's no explosives in them.
Right.
Just propaganda.
Propaganda. Certificates guaranteeing German soldiers safe conduct through the lines, food and medical care if they would surrender.
Mm-hmm.
And the intelligence people told us it worked.
Mm-hmm.
They did come through the lines. So it was a way of saving lives.
But at the time, you didn't even know what was written on there.
No, still don't.
How much did they tell you at the time?
I don't remember any information about what was on the leaflets. Some of the time, because communications broke down, like for Holland, we would fly the news to them. I know that.
Mm-hmm.
And the Battle of the Bulge is when Hitler said, we're going to push you off the continent. When that didn't happen, great psychological advantage for the Allies. So we flew a lot after the Battle of the Bulge.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure if people were listening closely enough, they heard night leaflet squadron. So most B-17 pilots did the bulk of their flying during daylight hours. B-24 pilots, same thing. You did all your flying at night?
Yes. Took off at dusk.
And before you went overseas, had you had any experience in night flying?
Some, but not unusual. Not more than anybody else, you know.
So how did you feel about that?
It was all right, you know. It's what we were assigned to do, like I'm repeating myself. That's what we did.
Yeah, for 43 missions, all alone in the dark of night. And we're going to explore some of those missions and hear about some of the close calls when we come back. If you want to see Mr. Mold putting on his Army Air Corps dress jacket that still fits after 70 years, visit the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we'll be right back after this. You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, listening to a 91-year-old World War II bomber pilot whose 43 missions in B-17s and B-24s were not what you might expect. He talks about it pretty nonchalantly, but the truth is, his work in the war was part of a secret strategy of psychological warfare. Look up the book Secret Squadrons of the Eighth by Pat Carty if you want to read more about the 406th Night Leaflet Squadron, black-painted American bombers flying at night from Cheddington, England, and dropping millions of propaganda leaflets designed to hasten Germany's surrender. Very few people knew about it at the time, and I'm guessing many of you listening on all our Hometown Heroes stations today have never heard of it either. Let's get back to Eugene Mold of Modesto, California. How did you feel about this secret work that you were doing?
I was glad I didn't have to drop explosives.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you about, because you said something a moment ago. You said the idea was to save lives.
Yeah.
To save German lives, to save American lives.
Yes.
So all these bomber crews all over Europe throughout the war, they're dropping bombs that part of the harsh reality is they're going to take lives.
Exactly.
Could be enemy lives, could be American lives, and that happened both ways.
Yeah.
But here you're dropping something designed to save lives.
Yes.
That's pretty amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm really grateful I had that kind of duty.
Even though you had signed up for what you thought was going to be the opposite.
Yeah, exactly, yes.
The other distinction that strikes me, and again, I don't want to be telling you what you did. I want you to tell me what you did. But most bomber pilots who I've talked to, they flew in formation with other planes.
Yeah.
It depended on when they were over there. They had fighter escort on their bomb runs. How did you guys fly your missions?
We flew alone at night, no fighter escort. The British flew at night also, of course, in what we referred to as big fuzzy clusters. You can't fly formation at night very well. So if they were flying, the Germans would concentrate their anti-aircraft fire on them because of their huge numbers. And that was our protection. Mm-hmm. I hate to say it, we were glad when the British were flying the same night we were, because we knew we were probably really safe.
Because the British were flying actual bombing missions,
yes,
trying to hit targets, and you guys are flying propaganda missions to drop these leaflets or supplies or whatever.
So the Americans flew in the daytime, the formation flying, like you said. The British flew at night. That kept up the psychological pressure on the Germans.
Yeah. And they're big fuzzy clusters, as you described it. I like that. So you actually found comfort and safety in them drawing attention away, but that doesn't change the fact that you're up there all by yourself.
Yeah, you, when we saw the anti-aircraft fire coming up, we saw it, you know. If you didn't know what it was, you would think it was sort of beautiful. It was like 4th of July, you know. But it's deadly, so, it, you know.
you're just blowing people's minds right now. You know, everything they've ever thought about bomber pilots in World War II is going out the window. You're saving lives, not taking lives, and it was like the 4th of July. You're enjoying a fireworks show up there. Yeah. I don't know what you're going to tell us next.
I'll tell you about a near mid-air collision.
Well, that doesn't sound like a picnic. Go ahead.
Sometimes when we flew, because of the weather or other reasons, we would get notice that the mission was scrubbed. We call that an abortion. And the radio operator would get a message in code through Morse code that he would have to take and decode and then tell me the mission is scrubbed. So we'd have to go back to our base, and we didn't get credit for a mission, of course. Mm-hmm. But as I was waiting for the tower to stack us up every 500 feet so we'd be safe from each other, way out there in the distance, I saw the lights of another airplane headed toward me. And I know how to read the lights, so I knew it was headed toward me, not away from me. And we were closing probably at 400 miles an hour. Mm. There's no time to analyze. Because you're getting, you know, a matter of minutes, you're going to collide. So for whatever reason, I went up and the other pilot went down. And so we did not kill 20 men like we could have.
And if you had both made the same choice, if you had both gone up or you'd both gone down?
We'd have killed 20 people.
Wow.
Yeah.
Pretty sobering.
Yeah, yes. And then once in a while, one of the gunners would say, there's a fighter out there. We had lights in the cockpit. Yellow meant we're being tracked by any aircraft. Orange meant they're firing any aircraft. Red meant there's a fighter tracking you. As you can guess, we didn't like red.
I would guess not.
So one of the gunners fired on a fighter. I never saw it. Never knew for sure if it was enemy or friendly. Mm-hmm. But we have fired our guns in combat, but not very often.
And you said something about that near collision. You know how to read the lights to tell if they're going away or coming towards you. For those of us who don't, how would you explain that?
Well, I don't remember anymore, but the red would be on one side and green would be on the other, so you could tell.
Uh-huh. So it's just picking up the color of it.
Yeah, yeah. And then we would have had our running lights on because we were still over England.
And you flew a total of 43 missions.
Yes, I did, which was 250 combat hours. Because our duty was considered somewhat less dangerous, we didn't have the deal of 25 or 30 missions. We had so many combat hours.
Mm-hmm. And you flew some of those in B-17, some in B-24.
About half and half, yes.
And would that represent two airplanes or more like seven or eight as far as actual aircraft?
Probably three or four, maybe uh-huh. four, yeah.
So you had some familiarity. It wasn't like you're flying a different plane every day.
Correct, yes.
Did you ever get an airplane you weren't all that confident in?
No. Crew chiefs, maintenance people did a really nice job.
Did you ever have one with some interesting nose art?
No, I had one that, one of my other stories is and one engine fails, so I had to feather it, which means turns the prop into the wind so they won't mill and right. be a drag. Then I lost a supercharger on another engine. So I'm down to 2.5 engines out of 4. And we had a short-range radio so we could come on with a distress call, and the airport that heard you would respond and turn on their lights. And I put the wheels down to say my signal to, I want to land. And so I landed at an airport in France, downwind by mistake, which is not a good thing. And after we got onto the runway, the left landing gear collapsed. So we didn't roll down the runway. We skidded sideways down the runway. And nobody ever flew that plane again, we heard.
Wow.
And we got out of the airplane, and we did what we had to do after an 8-hour flight. And
had a couple drinks?
No. Took care of our physical needs.
Used the restroom? Yeah, all right.
Yeah, and kissed the ground.
And kissed the ground.
Did those two things in different places.
Well, I would hope so. Good point. Well, and you described that very mundanely, very matter-of-factly, but this seems pretty nerve-wracking to me. This is dark outside.
Yes.
It's at night. You lose one engine. You lose half of another. And you've got, what, a 10-man crew that you're responsible for?
Yes.
What goes through your mind in that situation?
Well, after we got back to our, they flew us back to our base in England, and we got another plane. Uh-huh. We were kind of nervous about flying missions for a while, but eventually we adjusted again and we were okay. But
And how long was it from when you lost that power to when you actually landed?
Probably an hour or so.
That's a pretty nerve-wracking hour.
Yeah, and it was cold. There was ice in the cockpit, you know.
That's another thing people don't realize.
Yeah.
You didn't have pressurized cabins?
No, we didn't.
How cold would it be in one of those B-17s?
I don't remember that, but I know in the cockpit we had heat and we had electrical suits.
Yep.
The gunners, like the waist gunners and so on, they just had electrical suits to keep warm. Yeah. So we were flying at 20,000 feet. I don't remember the temperature, but it was freezing.
Yeah, I've heard quite a bit below zero from people. Did your electric suit always work?
Yes.
Good.
Yeah.
I've talked to a few guys who had them go out on them. Okay. They weren't very comfortable.
Yeah.
But still, you're cold. There's ice in the cockpit. It's pitch black outside. You don't really know where you are. You've got a navigator that's trying to figure out where you are?
Yeah, the navigator knows. Now, the navigator was really sharp. He knew where we were. We didn't know where the emergency airfields were until we went on the radio with our short-range call.
You probably also don't know what's enemy territory and what's friendly.
No.
So I'm sure there's all kinds of thoughts going through your mind. You could end up in enemy territory. You could end up going down.
Yes, exactly, yes.
And you've got all these other lives that you're responsible for.
Yeah, I don't remember, but the crew told me that I told them after we landed and stopped to come out with their hands up because we weren't sure where we were and we didn't want to get shot. So.
Wow. And that wasn't...
But they thought I saved their life. They told me that at a crew reunion. I never thought of that before.
Uh-huh. But, just by bringing that plane down safely?
Yeah, yeah.
And here you probably didn't think that was your best landing.
No. Tell you about my best landing. I knew what my last mission was because I knew how many hours I had in combat. And I decided I'm going to do a really nice job of putting it down for the last time, what we call greasing it on.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a psychological thing. I bounced it 3 times.
You're that guy on the 18th hole with a chance to win the Masters who 4-putts, huh?
Yeah.
Well, mine would have been worse, I'm sure. But so this landing, though, this night landing with the disabled, was that a B-17?
Or B-20? Yes.
B-17. So you said you came downwind, so you don't have the control in that situation.
Yeah, you're more likely to float rather than get on the ground.
Right.
Yeah.
And then when you do hit the ground, your left landing gear collapses.
Yes.
So then that side of the plane goes into the ground and is sparking away as you skid down the runway?
Exactly, yes.
Yeah.
And we had a kill switch because if there's any leaking gasoline in the spark, then it's all over.
So you hit the kill switch?
Yes, and I told them to get out, come out with your hands up, then I hit the kill switch.
Well, it probably took you a while to skid to a stop, too, right?
Yes, it did, yes.
Did you know that you actually were going to stop, or were you concerned you might hit something or end up in a ditch?
I don't remember all of that. That's fuzzy.
And I know I'm not trying to belabor the point, but not too many people go through something like that. And I think we all just wonder, you know, what do you do in that moment? Are you gritting your teeth? Are you closing your eyes? Are you saying a prayer? I mean, what are you doing?
You know, I don't remember what I'm doing to be. Maybe I'm blocking some of that psychologically.
Sure.
Could be. Yeah.
But what you do know is at a reunion with that crew, they said, hey, you saved our life.
Yes, yes.
I
had never thought
feel?
Of that before.
Yeah, it never occurred to you before?
No.
So when they said that, it must have made quite an impression.
Yes, it was, yes. It was nice of them to tell me that.
Of all those 43 missions, was there a moment that maybe took your breath away the most or got your attention in the most severe way?
When the release mechanism on bombs failed, then the flight engineer had to go out in the bomb bay with a portable oxygen mask and kick them out manually. And so that happened to us once, and we were circling a target, which, of course, is not a good thing because they'll find you eventually.
Yeah.
While we were doing that, the ball turret gunner said, there's a searchlight on us. Well, there was no searchlight on us. It was a full moon. Well, that lets you know that, you know, we're under stress. I mean, he sees the moon, he thinks it's a searchlight. And we didn't like to get hit by a searchlight because if they can see you, they can hit you.
Sure.
Yeah.
And there's nothing to help you. You're all by yourself. You're the only plane up there.
Yeah. The other thing I remember, when one of the gunners said, there's a fighter out there. We had a bomber can't outrun a fighter. Your only defense is to try to dive and get away. So I did what we were trained to do, was called a corkscrew, which you can imagine is put the airplane up on one wing and dive and circle down. Mm. And that's what I was doing. And the crew told me later, that's the most violent corkscrew they'd ever been through. So I was reacting to, there's a fighter out there.
Yeah. Did you guys have to clean anything off the plane after that?
I don't remember that. No, I don't think so, no.
I think a few people might get a little sick to their stomachs from that kind of maneuver.
Yeah.
Well, we've heard about some adventures Eugene Mould experienced during World War II, but there's a more recent experience he's going to tell us about as well. He and his wife, Anita, just celebrated their 71st anniversary. Maybe we'll hear from her for a moment, too. If you happen to live in Modesto, California, I know you can find the Moulds at Trinity United Presbyterian Church this weekend. Tell them happy anniversary if you do. And if you can't see them in person, you can still find photos of them then and now at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. The rest of his story is coming up right after this. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with 91-year-old Eugene Mould, a husband for 71 years to Anita, father of four, grandfather to 14, and now even great-grandpa to five more. He might have been your math teacher, your principal, your college instructor, but none of that would be true if he hadn't survived 43 missions with the 406th Night Leaflet Squadron, the B-17s and B-24s he piloted, dropping propaganda leaflets over Europe, secret psychological warfare that most of us have never heard of before.
When was it that you came to understand the full nature of the work that you had done and the impact that it had had in dropping these leaflets, not just for German soldiers, but for civilians as well?
probably after I got out of the service and met with the crew and talked it over. And, you know, we finally realized the significance of what we had done.
Mm-hmm. Were you even allowed to talk about it when you were doing it?
After a mission, we would talk to intelligence, our people, of course. But
sure.
But no, nobody instructed me not to talk about it after I got out. No.
Uh-huh.
No.
But, I mean, for instance, while you were flying these missions, because this is a fairly long period of time that you're flying these missions, letters home, were you allowed to say what you were doing?
No. No, she didn't know what I was doing. I would write a letter and say, don't worry about me, but she didn't know what that meant, and I couldn't tell her.
Uh-huh.
And I couldn't say where I was in England, just somewhere in the United Kingdom.
And if you said it, they probably would have taken a little razor blade and cut it out.
Yeah, yeah.
How often did you get mail from her?
Neither of us remembers for sure. maybe once a week or something like that.
You have all the letters all these years later.
Yeah, yeah.
Now that you do understand what it was that you did, and you mentioned reunions, and we've got a great picture of you with your crew in World War II and with the same crew standing in the same spots all these years later, what are you proud of? What gives you satisfaction in the work that you got to do?
Well, that I completed my missions, that nobody was hurt. We were all safe. We all came back in one piece. The ball turret gunner had a few mental or psychological problems, but he still functioned. Mm-hmm. He's from Massachusetts. He was a letter carrier, and he was okay. But when we got back, they interviewed us. I thinking back, it was probably a psychiatrist, but I can remember telling him, I'm fine. I'm okay. Mm-hmm. Don't worry about me.
And were you able to keep that same crew together for most of your missions?
Yes.
What did that do for those relationships? How would you describe the camaraderie that you had with those guys?
Well, we were good friends, and we obviously depended on each other during the missions. We depended on the navigator to get it back to our base.
Mm-hmm. What kind of stuff do you guys talk about at a reunion? What would we hear if we were a fly on the wall?
Well, some of the missions that we were in somewhat of danger, what we did and how we were now and what families we had. The oldest on the crew was 22. The youngest was 19.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah. So you don't come to full realization of what's going on or what's happening until it's all over.
Well, and I'm sure 25 years after the war, when you become principal at Modesto High School and you've got an 18-year-old in your office, you're probably wondering, hey, I had guys this age flying on my plane with me. When did you come back from England?
On my wife's birthday. I got back to Concord, California on her birthday, March 26, 45.
Uh-huh. Quite a birthday present.
Yeah.
Did she know you were coming?
Yes, yes. Uh-huh. And then I re-enrolled at UC Berkeley. But I was sent to Liberal, Kansas, and then to Smyrna, Tennessee, where I was trained to be a B-24 instructor. But by then I had enough points, so I trained to be an instructor, but I never served as an instructor. Just got out of the service.
Mm-hmm. Became a math teacher.
Yes, I did.
In all those years in education, did you ever tell any of your students about what you did in the war?
Yes, yes. I would do that like the day before Christmas vacation. I would just talk about World War II rather than teach a math lesson.
Would you wear your jacket?
No.
The jacket that you still fit into, this is the same one you were wearing 70 years ago?
Yes, yes. That's the dress jacket. That's not for combat. That's dress.
Right, right. Yeah. Yeah. You needed something a little more substantial if you're flying up at 20,000 feet.
Yeah. And you had to have a parachute harness and everything.
Uh-huh. And six times you were cited with the Air Medal. That means you're up there quite a bit. You did some things that mattered. Does that mean anything to you?
Yeah, I'm proud that I was awarded that. It's, to be honest, not a high-level medal. If you're good enough to survive enough combat hours, you get an Air Medal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's kind of on automatic.
Well, guys tell me the same thing about the Distinguished Flying Cross, but you flew the 43 missions. We didn't, and we certainly didn't do it at night all by ourselves in one plane. And you know, that's one thing I was going to ask you about your crew. A lot of the Air Corps veterans that I've talked to on bomber crews, there was a connection within the crew, but a lot of times the officers would hang out with other officers from other planes and other crews. With you guys flying alone so much, do you think your crew became more tight-knit than maybe a regular bomber crew might have?
Yeah, probably so. But then, you know, there was the officers' club and the enlisted men's club, so we didn't socialize when we weren't flying.
Did you have other guys on your crew that were married like you were?
Yes. Yes, the navigator was married. The co-pilot was married. That's all.
So that just piled on a little more responsibility on you to get them home, huh?
Yeah, yeah.
Do you ever think about that? Do you think about those close calls, losing the engines, anti-aircraft fire, that corkscrew dive to get away from a fighter plane, and think about your children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren? And
yeah. If I hadn't survived all that, they wouldn't exist, of course. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think about it. Yes, I do.
You would have left Anita a widow instead of getting ready for your 71st anniversary.
Yes, yes. Wouldn't have been able to go on honor flight like I did last October with you. And
yeah.
Yeah, that was an incredible experience, and I thank you.
Well, the whole idea is we're trying to thank you guys for what you did, and I know you turned a lot of heads wearing that uniform, that dress jacket in Washington, D.C.
I was accused of being a chick magnet because I had my Army Air Corps jacket on when we were visiting monuments and memorials.
How did Anita feel about that?
She didn't know until I got back.
What happens in Washington stays in Washington.
Yeah.
For you, and you've been in Modesto since 1950, so that's 65 years here in the San Joaquin Valley. And Castle Air Force Base, for most of that time, was an active base, and you had the B-52s flying right over you here in Modesto. So to be able to take off and land on that runway, did that mean something to you?
I didn't fly from Castle.
I know you didn't specifically, but but just knowing the history of that
base. Oh, yeah, yeah. Could relate to that. And I remember well after the war, there was a B-17 at Modesto Airport.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in our house, and it flew over, and I said, that's a B-17. I just knew the sound.
Yeah.
I don't know how I know the sound, but I know that I recognized it.
I bet you probably know a B-24 if it flew over right now, too.
Yeah, yeah.
And I know you'd know a P-51.
Yes. Yeah.
Even though you never flew one.
No, I never did. Yeah.
You mentioned the honor flight. What was the best part of that experience for you?
World War II Memorial, Air Force Memorial, Arlington National Cemetery, changing of the guard, all very meaningful and emotional, and in some cases physically demanding.
Sure.
The second day, as you know, was a pretty full day.
Well, how long were those night flying missions you flew?
Up to 8 hours.
All right.
Yeah.
So what was more physically demanding, 8 hours in the air at night over Europe or that long day in D.C.?
The mission. The mission, yeah.
And in Washington, D.C., did you take care of business and then kiss the ground in a different spot?
No, I did not.
At that World War II memorial, there are a lot of different aspects of it.
Yeah.
What made the biggest impression on you, and what did you reflect on in the time that you were
there? Well, I thought it was very impressive. The Atlantic side is where I flew. They had Atlantic Pacific side, and people coming up to me because I was wearing my jacket and saying, is that the original? And ladies coming up to me and with their kids. And I offered to let the kids wear my jacket, and a few of them did, and we took pictures. And a man from Thailand with a couple of women came up to me and asked, are you a general? No, I was just the first lieutenant.
You didn't stick a couple extra stars on there somewhere, did you?
No.
Yeah, I didn't see those. What about the homecoming back in Atwater at Castle?
Very impressive, very emotional. I'll never forget that. You know, we walked down that line with people on either side and waving to us and clapping. It was meaningful and emotional.
Did it make you feel like people understood?
Yes, and appreciated.
Mission accomplished then. You know, I want to ask you a little bit more about the leaflets and that duty, because it is such a unique aspect of World War II that probably a lot of people listening today have never heard of before and had no clue that that was happening. If you can educate us a little bit about that and how you would explain its significance or what gives you pride in having carried out that task.
Yeah, I feel good about the surrender certificates we dropped the German soldiers, and informing people in Holland about what's going on. And when the German communications broke down, our intelligence would print up leaflets and telling them what to do. And it looked like it was from, we called it black propaganda. It was telling the German soldiers what to do and looking like it came from their command, but it came from us instead.
Uh-huh.
So advising them to surrender and where to go and what to do. So those are all things that I think that help save lives.
And again, this is something that really no one knew was happening at the time. Does that ever make you wonder what's happening these days?
Yeah, sure. I have no idea if they do that now.
They probably have a very high-tech way of doing it.
Yeah.
And I know you gave Anita a great birthday present in 1945 by showing back up in Concord on her birthday. But do you remember when you heard about VE Day and really that the ultimate culmination of what you guys were doing over there had actually happened and Germany had surrendered?
Yeah, that's when we were in Liberal, Kansas.
Uh-huh.
We heard about that, yes.
Was that meaningful?
Yes, it was. And we went to a church service that same day because that's who we are.
71 years. That's a pretty big number for your anniversary. And I did have one veteran from down the road in Merced. They'd been married 72 years, and I asked him the secret, and he said, you just got to make it past 60. If you can get through the first 60, the rest of it, you're just coasting. That wasn't very encouraging to me, but...
That's a good answer.
What do you say about that, to be married for more than 70 years and still enjoy each other's company as much as you
can? Yeah, we absolutely do. And then the word I use is compromise. That's probably a cliche, but it's true for us. We feel very blessed. We have health and we have all those years of marriage. It's wonderful.
When you look back on it all, and I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, but I hear what you say and, you know, that you're in a church service because that's who you are and you feel very blessed. Are you one of those who say, you know, I think God was looking out for me while I was over there?
Yes, absolutely, yes. When I told the story about the near mid-air collision in church one Sunday, one lady said to me, God had other plans for you. So thank goodness.
Amen. And we have your wife, Anita, here too. Thanks to Hometown Heroes affiliate KFIV in Modesto for letting us invade the recording studio. And Anita, I asked him what the secret to a 71-year marriage was. What would you say?
Give and take, I guess. We know each other so well now that I don't think we've had an argument for years. Things are just smooth.
Like 2 years, 5 years, 20 years?
I really don't know. I don't know.
So when he was over there flying these missions, and you don't know what he's doing, you just know he's over there and it's probably dangerous.
That's right.
What were you doing back home?
I was taking classes at Berkeley.
There was a special spot on the Berkeley campus for you?
A bridge, and I would, at 10:30 in the morning, and I knew what time it was over in England, and I would stop there and pray for him.
I guess somebody heard those prayers.
Oh, God heard them, that's for sure.
He's still here. Is there anything else that he didn't say about himself that you think the rest of us should know? What goes through your mind when you see him standing up tall with that dress jacket on?
I'm proud of him. I'm proud of the things he went through in order to keep our country safe.
For sure. And back to Mr. Mold now. Since you're an educator, and that's kind of like being a Marine, I bet. Once an educator, always an educator.
I was principal at Modesto High. I got transferred to Downey High School. After that, I got transferred to what at that time was the two continuation high schools. Uh-huh. I retired in 83, got a job at Stanislaus State in the education department until 92.
All right.
So I retired twice.
Yeah.
I'm through retiring. That's all.
You're not going to retire one more time? No. Okay. Out there in the listening audience could be students you had at Modesto High School, at Downey, and continuation school, or college kids from the Turlock area.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. So there might be a lot of folks who are putting two and two together right now. But what I wanted to ask you in the vein of education, most of us alive today were not alive during World War II. We don't know what it was all about. We don't know how big it was, how dangerous the situations you folks put yourself in were, or really maybe what the significance of it all was. How would you encapsulate what you and 16 million other Americans did and why we need to remember it today?
I think that's a function of the United States. It's like on the playground, if somebody's being bullied, somebody needs to step in and take care of that situation. I think that's what the United States did in World War II. We stopped the bullies.
Yes, you did.
We served notice on them and were successful. I'm glad I did what I did. I wouldn't want to do it again.
Well, I'm glad you did what you did and you came home to tell about it. And I want to say thank you for serving our country and for telling us your very unique story. Is there anything else you think we need to know?
think we've covered it well.
Fair enough. Hop on hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page for photos relating to Mr. Mould's story. Thanks for listening to the program today. We learn something new every time, don't we? I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.